Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Peggy Ruprecht, assistant professor in the Department of Journalism, Media, and Computing at Creighton. This Thursday, April 6th, is the 100th anniversary of the United States' entry into World War I. Dr. Ruprecht will speak on the topic World War I and the Committee on Public Information. The original title of her talk was World War I, Woodrow Wilson and George Creel, The Selling of a War to the American Public. This program, part of the Reinert Alumni Memorial Library World War I lecture series, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, March 22, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Christine Carmichael, Reference and Web Services Librarian at the Reinert Alumni Memorial Library.
Peggy Ruprecht, Assistant Professor in the Department of Journalism, Media and Communications, Media and Computing, is here this morning for the title of the presentation, WW1, Committee on Public Committee of Public Information. Thank you for being here and for agreeing to do this for us. After obtaining her bachelor's degree in broadcast journalism and as a Hearst Journalism Award finalist, Dr. Ruprecht joined WBA-TV in Green Bay, Wisconsin, where she served as a reporter. She went on to work as a reporter and fill-in anchor for KMTV here in Omaha. Her most recent position was as the Director of Communications for the Westside Community School District, and she joined the Creighton faculty full-time in July of 2016. Dr. Ruprecht teaches public relations, information concepts, and the history of American mass media. She also is an affiliate faculty in Creighton's online doctoral program in interdisciplinary leadership. She attained a master's degree in journalism from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, earned her doctorate of philosophy in human sciences with a specialization in leadership studies from UNL in 2011. She is a member of the Association for Education in Journalism and Mass Communication and a member of the Public Relations Society of America. She currently serves on the PRSA Nebraska Chapter Board of Directors as the Community Service Chair. If you would, join me in welcoming Dr. Ruprecht to the podium.
Well, thank you and good morning, everyone. Last semester, when I began teaching my History of American Mass Media class, I was reintroduced to the work of American journalists throughout history. And one of those points in history that really caught my attention was World War I, when Woodrow Wilson established the Committee on Public Information, or the CPI, under the direction of George Creel. The committee was commonly referred to as the Creel Committee. This morning, I'm going to discuss how the committee's propaganda led to nationalism, blind loyalty, and a deep suspicion of the enemy. To get us started, I'm going to briefly touch on some of the issues that propelled us into the war. So in 1914, we have the Great War, the war to end all wars, which erupted among European nations in part because of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand and his wife Sophie. Ferdinand, as you may recall, was the Crown Prince of Austria. The United States initially declared its neutrality and took an isolationist stance. An ocean away, there was really no reason for the U.S. to get involved in the conflict. Most Americans did not want to enter the fight. At the time, we had a large immigrant population in our country. About a third of people living in the United States were immigrants who came to us from throughout Europe, including Ireland, England, as well as Germany and Russia. In fact, Wilson, during his second presidential campaign in 1916, narrowly won re-election with the campaign slogan, "He kept us out of the war." Once the fighting broke out in Europe, he publicly encouraged Americans to remain impartial on all fronts. Even though Wilson vowed to remain neutral, he had a closer connection to the Allied powers, particularly Great Britain. As a former professor and the president of Princeton University, Wilson was a scholar of British history. The connection was troubling to his Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, who was, of course, the great Nebraska orator and a pacifist. The two men were not close. Bryan had been appointed Secretary of State because he had a strong support in the Democratic Party. And Bryan felt Wilson's leanings would eventually propel the United States into the war. So the following year, Bryan resigned his position. The sinking of the Lusitania and attacks by U-boats on American merchant ships heightened tensions between the United States and Germany. Yet it didn't pose a direct threat to our national security. Wilson continued to allow these ships to carry food and other supplies to England, even issuing a directive to arm the merchant vessels. So although he proclaimed neutrality and vowed to stay out of the conflict, Wilson was showing his affinity toward the Allied nations. With tensions mounting, the Zimmermann telegram became the impetus to declare war on Germany. As you'll recall, the British Secret Service intercepted a coded communication from the German Foreign Minister, Arthur Zimmermann. Zimmermann sent a message to the German ambassador in Mexico asking him to explore a potential alliance with Mexico in the event that the United States and Germany went to war. In exchange for this alliance, Mexico would receive the states of Texas, Arizona, and New Mexico. Wilson released the contents of this message to an outraged American public. So on April 6th, 1917, Congress granted Wilson's request for a declaration of war. The country was not united in this decision. The declaration of war had its detractors. Nebraska Senator George W. Norris was among a handful of U.S. senators and members of Congress who voted in opposition of this war declaration. Jeanette Rankin, who was the first woman elected to Congress, also voted against it. Now, it's important to note here that the U.S. entered this war without any direct attack on American soil. And it left Wilson with a bit of a dilemma. How could a president who championed the cause of isolationism as part of his presidential campaign now build support among the American public to enter the war? This dilemma resulted in the establishment of the Committee on Public Information, or the CPI. Wilson formed the CPI a week after the war began. The committee was charged with providing information to the American public about the war effort. George Creel, he was appointed the civilian chairman of this committee. He had been a progressive journalist prior to the war, and he was a supporter of Wilson during the 1916 election. Very early in the war, the British government enlisted the help of English writers to promote propaganda. So Rudyard Kipling, Thomas Hardy, Arthur Conan Doyle all wrote articles about the Allied effort and offered American magazines and newspapers their work. But their contributions were nothing in comparison to the propaganda machine under Creel. The CPI produced massive amounts of pamphlets, news releases, editorials, speeches, political posters, and even patriotic films. Once the United States entered the conflict, Wilson was determined to implement a systematic program of censorship in the United States, including newspapers, magazines, and telegrams. He expected the press to fall in line with the patriotic messages. A censorship board was also enacted at this time. Socialist and German newspapers at the time who published anti-war sentiments were heavily impacted. Some lost their mailing privileges, which prevented them from getting their newspapers to readers. And George Creel, incidentally, was a member of that committee. Wilson drafted an executive order for the Navy to take control over all of the undersea cables, and he authorized the War Department to seize control of the telegraph and the telephone. So the American government controlled all of the communication channels between the United States and the rest of the world. By the summer, American troops were on their way to France to assist the Allies with the war effort. At the same time, Congress passed the Espionage Act of 1917 and later the Sedition Act of 1918, which was a set of amendments to the Espionage Act. Both acts targeted people who willingly expressed an anti-war sentiment or tried to publicly denounce the draft. Both acts gave the government broad powers to inhibit free speech, the free speech of Americans, and the American media. These acts, combined with the work of the Creel Committee, promoted patriotism among the American public while inhibiting dissent and free speech. Federal and state prosecutors filed criminal charges against thousands of people for what they wrote or said. Several of these cases made it to the Supreme Court, including the case of Charles Schenck and Eugene Debs. Both of these men were convicted during the war. Schenck was convicted for creating a pamphlet questioning the wartime draft. Eugene Debs, an internationally prominent socialist, he was a vocal critic of the war. He wrote for the publication Appeal to Reason and had a significant following in the United States. Debs was arrested for speaking out against the government, and at the age of 62, he was convicted and given a 10-year prison sentence. His sentence was later commuted. In Schenck versus the United States, we have the case of Charles Schenck, convicted of the Espionage Act for distributing a pamphlet critical of the draft. When his case made it to the Supreme Court, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote a unanimous opinion upholding the conviction. Writing for the court, Holmes said that this was the most stringent protection of free speech, and it would not protect a man who was falsely accused of shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. The Supreme Court ruled that Schenck tried to incite people to avoid the draft, and the Supreme Court's decision was unanimous. These cases, as you might imagine, had a chilling effect on free speech in our country. So back to the CPI. More than 150,000 people were involved with the Committee on Public Information in some way. The CPI had numerous divisions, including domestic and foreign sections, which influenced public opinion at home and abroad. The foreign division was responsible for propaganda overseas in more than 30 countries. The organization was attractive to progressives of the area, especially journalists and reform-minded intellectuals and scholars. These individuals were primarily liberal. They viewed the CPI not just as an organization to support the war effort and to instill patriotism, but perhaps more importantly, as an opportunity to move the country forward in reform efforts against government corruption and big business. They saw the CPI as an opportunity to preserve democracy. So remember, at the time, we were coming out of an era of muckraking journalism when individuals like Upton Sinclair wrote The Jungle, which provided a graphic description, a graphic account of the meatpacking industry, and Jacob Riis was exposing the harsh conditions of poor immigrants living in the slums. But interestingly enough, the committee was also attractive to individuals who had strong nationalistic feelings. In a 10-year period from 1907 to 1917, roughly 650,000 people came to the United States, primarily from Southern and Eastern Europe. Some Americans expressed concerns about the growing immigrant population and the potential loss of so-called American values as more and more of these individuals found their way to our nation's shores. Along with the sheer number of people who came to support the Committee on Public Information, you also had people from a variety of professions, including journalists, illustrators, public relations professionals, businessmen, advertisers, and artists. At no time in the history of our country did we have such a wide array of professionals who were coming together united under the same purpose. Now, after the war, some of these individuals would go on to have prominent careers in their own rights, including Edward Bernays, who has been called the father of modern public relations. He was the nephew of Sigmund Freud, the famous psychoanalyst. Bernays worked for the CPI in the Latin American News Division, and he was also responsible for securing the support of American businessmen for the war effort. Now, Bernays believed public relations should apply social science research and behavioral psychology to campaigns and messages. So I have one story to share about Bernays. In the 1920s, the American Tobacco Company hired Bernays to promote smoking among women. Yes, they actually promoted smoking. At the time, public smoking among women was considered taboo or not socially acceptable. Women just didn't generally smoke in public. Well, Bernays hired models to walk in the New York Easter Parade with lit cigarettes in their hands, wearing a banner that said, "Torches of Liberty." And by making smoking a symbol of liberation, sales went through the roof. So Bernays' involvement in the CPI really helped to shape his future career. Although as a public relations professional, I'd like to hope we were perhaps more ethical than that. So as propaganda about the war got underway, George Creel wanted to ensure that he reached all segments of his population, including women. Creel was supportive of the cause of women's suffrage, although he worked more quietly behind the scenes on the issue. Nonetheless, he understood the importance of connecting with women and providing them with information on how they could support the war effort. The government established the Women's Committee of the Council of National Defense, and Ida Tarbell was one of the women who was involved with this committee. Prior to the war, Tarbell had gained some fame as a muckraking journalist. While working for McClure's magazine, she wrote a 19-part investigative series, an expose, on John Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company. She and others believed that German aggression posed a threat to democracy. And we'll talk more about the role of women in the CPI in just a few minutes. As I mentioned earlier, the Committee on Public Information had a number of divisions, including a division of news. And following the war, Creel wrote a book about the CPI. And in his discussion about the news division, he stated that our job was to present the facts without the slightest trace of color or bias, either in the selection of news or the manner in which it was presented. And that would have been really nice had it been true. The news division operated 24 hours a day. Most journalists had contact with the CPI through this division. It was a propaganda machine that buried newspapers in news releases. Throughout the war, the division produced 6,000 press releases, more than 10 a day. Creel claimed that the formation of this committee in no way impeded journalists from their independent news gathering. Creel also maintained that the news division would be beneficial, especially to those rural or smaller newspapers that either weren't part of the wire service or didn't have the ability to send a correspondent to Washington to cover the war. He suggested that by having this news division, it was valuable to newspaper editors, since they didn't have to assign a reporter to cover the war effort. All the information would be handed to them in the news release. Yet he assured journalists they could write their own stories. Well, in spite of Creel's promises, the press had difficulty gathering information or gaining access to government officials, soldiers, military officers, and those involved in the war effort. As you can imagine, some members of the press described the news division as an agency of repression. And since American readers were clamoring for news about the war, these news releases began appearing in newspapers as news articles, especially in those smaller weekly papers throughout the country. In total, the information appeared in some 20,000 newspapers each week. George Creel implemented and was supportive of voluntary guidelines for the newspaper, voluntary guidelines, suggesting the government wanted to help patriotic papers support the war effort. But it was censorship nonetheless. The implication at the time was that if you didn't go along with this, you weren't patriotic. Journalists could even be viewed as traitors if they didn't fall in line with the CPI's acceptable standards. Now, the guidelines divided news into three categories: dangerous, questionable, and routine. Dangerous news consisted of stories written about troop movements, naval operations, or official missions. Questionable material was to be published only after getting the story approved by the CPI. Routine material only needed to be submitted if the newspaper editor had any questions about the story that was going to be published. If they were submitted, those stories would be given an official seal of approval. Now, some officials in the Wilson administration didn't really care for the notion of voluntary censorship. They wanted something more direct. But Creel felt that anything other than voluntary censorship would not have been possible with the American press. Most of the news that American newspapers received came from the news division of CPI. The news division tried to shape how newspapers covered the war. In addition to these news releases, the CPI began publishing its own newspaper called the Official Bulletin, which was a daily newspaper. The Committee on Public Information also published a book called The Meaning of America, urging readers to demand that immigrants speak English, learn the words to the Star-Spangled Banner, salute the flag, and encourage patriotism in children. And we'll talk a little bit more about this shortly. Among its ranks of CPI volunteers included the Four Minutemen. Some 75,000 people volunteered to give brief patriotic talks on everything from war bonds, draft registration, food conservation, and blood drives. The so-called Four Minutemen spoke at theaters while movie houses were changing the film reels. They also spoke at schools, community meetings, and other places where the public gathered. Really, any place where there was a public forum, that might have been an opportunity for a four-minute-man to appear. These four-minute-men even gave their speeches in various languages, including Italian and Yiddish, particularly in New York, which had a high number of immigrants, obviously. The four-minute-men were successful in their efforts. These were volunteers who gave scripted speeches primarily in their local communities. So they had some credibility because they were giving these speeches in their local communities. Businessmen were often chosen, and they were typically unpaid, but they were all very earnest in their support of the war effort. Now, the CPI issued four Minutemen bulletins, which offered standardized talks so they could all cover the same topic at roughly the same time. The government encouraged speakers to memorize their remarks, and their talks complemented the themes in other CPI literature, again including food conservation and registering to serve. In all, Creel counted more than 755,000 speeches given by this group of volunteers. The CPI even had what they called junior four-minute men. These were school children who received patriotic information to share with their classmates. Now, here's an interesting fact. Many of these public events involved the playing of the Star-Spangled Banner, since it was a popular patriotic song at the time. But interestingly enough, it was not yet the country's national anthem. The Star-Spangled Banner didn't officially become the national anthem until Congress passed a bill and President Hoover signed it into law in 1931. So I didn't realize that, but discovered that as I was researching this talk. At the same time, through the advertising division, Creel asked publications to donate space for various government war-related efforts to promote campaigns such as the selling of war bonds, to recruit soldiers, to plant victory gardens, or to promote patriotism. In his book, How We Advertised America, Creel referred to the CPI as the world's greatest adventure in advertising. He distanced himself from the laws at the time, the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act. He acknowledged that the limits that these laws posed on freedom of speech and freedom of the press. During a 1918 forum in New York, Creel was asked if absolute freedom of speech was even possible during a war. And he apparently stated that in a war, more than any other time, we need to have freedom of speech because we need to have that dialogue. We need to have that criticism. So here was an interesting point. Creel was a member of the censorship board, and records indicate that he was an active member of the board and was involved in censoring certain kinds of material. Yet he found himself conflicted as a former journalist, and at times he used his influence on the board to curtail the censor's authority. But by being a member of the censorship board, he lost some of his credibility as a champion of free speech. Advertising agencies organized themselves, their copywriters, and various artists to create posters and other artwork that supported the war effort. The CPI also had a division for this, CPI's Division of Pictorial Publicity. Charles Dana Gibson headed this committee. In 20 months, the Division of Pictorial Publicity created some 700 designs. One account that I read indicated that the illustrators and artists volunteered their time. No one was paid for their work, and some of the artwork was even unsigned. The division created some iconic images. One of the more famous came from the artist James Montgomery Flagg. He produced the image of Uncle Sam saying, "I want you for the U.S. Army." The image has been used repeatedly since that time. The artwork that was produced in this era focused around some key themes. The first, of course, primarily included patriotic themes. Loyalty to the United States was heavily promoted. The patriotism that was promoted encouraged men to enlist in the military. Women were not allowed to enlist as soldiers, so it was up to the men of the country to take up the fight. Another theme that was present at this time dealt with food conservation, so that American soldiers stationed overseas would have enough to eat. So it was in this realm that the CPI reached out to women with these images about war gardens, about not wasting food. Especially women journalists who wrote for the local social sections or the women's section of their daily newspapers. As I previously discussed, women were not allowed to enlist, so they found that they had to serve their country in other ways. They organized blood drives for the Red Cross. They received information on how to be thrifty at home. In one local paper, a woman journalist offered tips to other women for avoiding food waste and provided creative ways to use leftover meat, bread, and vegetables. The Women's Committee of the Council of National Defense sent news and feature articles to nearly 20,000 newspapers and magazines, specifically targeting information for women. This division also responded to correspondence from women, answering their questions about the war in order to keep up morale. Still another poster theme showed the Germans in a very negative light. They portrayed Germans as barbarians who committed all sorts of wartime atrocities. Promoting this hatred and fear of the enemy came at an opportune moment in our country. For years, the new immigrants arriving in the United States, the country had an identity crisis. And many Americans who were already established were resentful of the new immigrants. Many of these immigrants were coming from Eastern Europe. Here in the United States, anti-German sentiment ran high. Several of the accounts that I read talked about towns bearing German names that actually changed them. So here in Nebraska, there was a town of Berlin that changed its name to Odo. Schools banned the teaching of German. Libraries disposed of German literature. During the war, we also saw the banning or the canceling of performance by German musicians. Even the playing of the music of Beethoven was discouraged. The government demanded blind loyalty and allegiance. People were asked to watch for un-American behaviors among their neighbors and their friends. So here you have Americans, some of whom might have been relatively unsophisticated or naive. They were swept up in the emotion, and they wanted to be patriotic and support their country. They became willing to spy on their neighbor or friend. The CPI played to the emotions of the public, really in all of its divisions, played to the emotions rather than to facts. Creel and the CPI were later criticized for encouraging citizens to engage in this type of behavior. The committee's film division produced movies to help rally support. The film division was a very important division of the CPI. With the advent of film, you had a relatively new medium or technology that you're introducing to the American public. And when they could, Americans attended the movies. It provided them with a distraction from the war and from their everyday life. So here you have, so Creel has a captive audience to reach with his wartime messages. And as I mentioned earlier, the Four Minutemen would often give their speeches in movie houses while the film reels were being changed. CPI produced film reels and films. They produce newsreels, I should say, and films such as Pershing's Crusaders, America's Answer, and Under Four Flags. These films were captioned so they could be distributed to foreign audiences throughout the world. The CPI spent about 6 weeks producing each of these films. Commercially produced films also dealt with the war, such as Cecil B. DeMille's The Little American, featuring Mary Pickford, who was the darling or the sweetheart at the time. During the war, the pro-war movie trailers were commonplace as Americans headed to the cinema. The film division expended a little over $1 million in the production of various newsreels and films, and in the end, they collected some $850,000 from worldwide distributions. In fact, as I mentioned, some of the films went abroad, some 6,200 reels of film. Money collected by the Division of Film helped the United States distribute their films to neutral countries. So as we end our discussion today, I want to share with you a quote from George Creel in one of the books he authored after the war, when he was talking about his experiences with Woodrow Wilson and the Committee on Public Information. Creel stressed that the CPI's goals were ultimately to be positive, to share the good news about the war effort. He said, "We did not call it propaganda, for that word in German hands had come to be associated with deceit and corruption. Our effort was educational and informative throughout." I want you to pause briefly as you reflect on this statement. We'll return to it in just a moment. The CPI brought together a really interesting array of individuals at a really critical time in our history. On one hand, you had progressives and liberals. These were the muckrakers exposing corruption and believing that by working toward a common cause, they could strengthen democracy. These people believed in their efforts, and they believed they could reform our democracy. And in fact, following the war, we would see some of these reforms with the passage of the 18th Amendment regarding prohibition and the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote. Working alongside these reformers were people who supported a nationalistic ideology, who opposed people speaking out against the war, and who wanted to Americanize the immigrant population. Wilson, of course, believed that this nationalism should come ahead of anything else. Creel himself was an interesting man of contrasts. He claimed to be a supporter of the free press, yet he hampered journalists' ability to gather information themselves, instead requiring them to print government news releases. He claimed to be a supporter of free speech, saying it was necessary to have public dialogue, yet he was part of a committee that censored information, and he worked for a government that prosecuted people who spoke out against the war. He kept information from the public and engaged in censorship while arguing against it. Finally, he claimed the mission of the CPI was not at all like the German propaganda, but rather a means to educate and inform. Yet the posters created by the Division of Pictorial Publicity showed Germans as barbaric, as savages, which ultimately led to anti-German sentiments and neighbors spying on one another. The CPI formally disbanded by an act of Congress on June 30th, 1919. And a year later, Creel wrote his book, How We Advertised America, in which he explained and defended the CPI as a necessary committee to promote patriotism in our country. In spite of its relatively short history, it remains a powerful example of a wartime propaganda machine, the likes of which we had not seen before or since in this country. And I would be happy to take your questions.
Hi, my question is, was there any way to see how successful the committee was in its work? I know today we have lots of metrics and polls and things like that. How did they gauge the success or of the committee during that time?
You know, you've asked a question that I don't have an answer for. I know that Creel wrote two books after he left the committee, after the committee was formally disbanded. And it was very clear in those books that he had a lot of pride in the work that people did. He would cite all of the individuals who were involved in it. And at least one of the books, the last book that the last quote that I shared, How We Advertised America, he seemed to defend his position. But, you know, perhaps there was a metric, and I just didn't get to that in my research. So thanks for that answer, for that question.
I wonder, and I just tangentially know this history, but thinking about how the Civil War was portrayed and the advent of photography and graphic photographs of battle imagery and people being killed and this sort of thing. And a lot of critical reporting at that time on both sides. And later, thinking of other popular press accounts like the Charge of the Light Brigade coming out. I can't remember which war that was, but somewhat prior to World War One. So what is the precedent for the creation of this, you know, institution in previous experiences, because I don't think there was really anything like that instituted before. So if you had any thoughts on that, and again,
sure.
I don't really know, but I'm interested in your perspective.
You know, censorship, of course, is nothing new in our country. Even Abraham Lincoln engaged in censorship during the Civil War. With the Sedition Act of 1798, the Federalists tried to censor the Republican press. And so that in and of itself was nothing extraordinary. We had had these times throughout history. Pre-Revolutionary War, we had the British government trying to censor colonial presses. But what struck me about this time period was the sheer number of people who came together and the fact that they came from such diverse backgrounds. You know, if you liken it to today, imagine a committee that you had the most conservative Republican and the most liberal Democrat who were working side by side. And they had separate purposes, perhaps, separate reasons for joining the effort. But nonetheless, they were all involved in the effort. And I don't know, I think that the Creel Committee was just the perfect template, the Committee on Public Information, for running a propaganda campaign on really all fronts, from news, from the images, from the films. And it took a tremendous amount of effort, and the volume of work that they produced was really extraordinary. As I mentioned, the news division was a 24-hour operation that was just a machine continually cranking things out. So I think just a really unique, extraordinary time in our country.
This is kind of a comment more on the question, and your answer is, I'm wondering too if it's the, by this time was the first time we really had mass media in the country, in the magazines, the national magazines, the national press, the cities were growing bigger, urbanization, immigration, all those kinds of things. Certainly radio was around at this time, right?
It was just starting to be formed, right. But it wasn't. It was after the war because they used the technology in the war to
and movies. So I think part of it was there wasn't really the mass media that we think of today, and they were just starting to really make use of that. Wouldn't you agree with that, Peter?
And that's an interesting insight too. You know, as I look at the work of the Four Minutemen, you know, this was the early. Perhaps the early Twitter storm or whatever, that here were people that were given the exact same information, the same script to release it at about the same time. And they were all speaking with that one voice. And, you know, obviously social media wasn't around back then, but here was an opportunity for a mass communication effort. And as you mentioned, this new technology, really film in particular, here was a medium that was brand new, And this was a kind of an innocent country. The people had come here maybe probably recently, immigrants for the most part, at least a third of them, wanting to believe that the government was doing the right thing, perhaps a little naive, and caught up in the emotion. And that's what the Committee on Public Information really played to. They played into the emotion, played into the hysteria. There weren't a lot of facts that were being thrown around for people to reflect on. It was really the images that they produced to evoke passion and patriotism and emotion.
I'm wondering about kind of the legacies of this committee and the Espionage Act and some of that stuff. What still remains from that, and what are we still dealing with today?
So the Espionage Act is still in effect. The Sedition Act ended. And we have seen throughout history this come up. The Pentagon Papers, for instance, during the Watergate era, they tried to use that Espionage Act to discourage or to prevent the New York Times from releasing those documents. And so, yeah, very interesting, you know, that we have legislation that is as old as it is, but still something to be considered today.
You mentioned earlier in your talk that speaking foreign languages was discouraged, but the Four Minute Men delivered their talks in different languages. Had anybody ever noticed the contrast between and the irony of this?
Yeah, there were some ironies in that, but you know, the ultimate goal of the committee at the time was to Americanize, to develop a sense of nationalism, and to reach all people with the message. So, and they did that in whatever way that they could. So I found it very interesting, too, and when I was doing my research on this topic, the fact that they were giving these talks in other languages, particularly in New York. Thank you so much for being with us today.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Peggy Ruprecht, assistant professor in the Department of Journalism, Media, and Computing at Creighton. This Thursday, April 6th, is the 100th anniversary of the United States' entry into World War I. Dr. Ruprecht spoke on the topic, World War I and the Committee on Public Information. The original title of her talk was World War I, Woodrow Wilson and George Creel, The Selling of a War to the American Public. This program, part of the Reinert Alumni Memorial Library World War I Lecture Series, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday morning, March 22, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.